Jai Saparika Shisi Guru Guranga Radha Shamsunda Girdhari Jiu Ki Jai. Jai Srimad Bhagavad Gita Upanishad Ki Jai. Jai Srimad Bhagavad Gita Study Group Ki Jai. Last week we finished chapter 18. So this evening we're going to discuss the Gita in summary, go through each chapter in a very short way, and we can have some discussion about that. And then this will be our last class for a while, Gita class. And watch this space, we'll resume again, and we'll let everybody know when that'll be. First, I want to read the summary from The Glories of the Gita, published in Srila Sridhar Maharaj's translation. Gita Shastram Idam Punyam Jatpate Prayata Pumam Vishnupadam Abapnoti Bayashokadibhajita Gita Jayana Shilasya Pranayama Parashyacha Naiva Shanti Hi Papani Purva Janma Kritani Cha Manlanir mochanam pungsam jalasnanam dine dine sakrid gitam vasishnanam sangsara malanashanam gita sugita kartabya kim anyai shastra vistarai ya swayam padmanabhasya mukha padmad vinishrita. This Bhagavad Gita scripture is the bestower of all good. One who regularly studies it with devotion will attain to the holy abode of Lord Vishnu, the plane of freedom from all distress, fear, and sorrow. For a self-controlled person who seriously studies this Bhagavad Gita scripture, not a trace of sin from this life or even from the previous life remains, as all the sins of such a person are burnt to ashes. As a person bathes every day to cleanse the body, similarly, by bathing only once in the waters of the Bhagavad Gita, reading the Gita once with devotion, all the dirt of painful material existence is washed away.
What page is it?
323. The Gita should always be sung with devotion. This divine song emanated from the holy lotus mouth of the Supreme Lord Himself, Lord Sri Krishna. What more can any other scripture give? Bharatam rita sarvasam vishnuvakrit vinishritam gita gangodakam vitva purna janmanna vidyate sarvopanishado gavo dogdagopalanandana Parto vatsa sudir bhokta dugdam gitam nittam mahat ekam shastram devaki putram gitam eko devo devaki putra eva eko mantras tasya namani jani karma pyekam tasya devasya seva. By drinking the Ganges water of the Gita, by singing the Gita with devotion, the nectar of the Mahabharata emanating from the lotus mouth of Lord Vishnu, one will never take birth in the material world again. All the Upanishads are as a cow, and the milker of the cow is Sri Krishna, the son of Nanda. Arjuna is the calf, the nectar of the Gita is the milk, and the fortunate devotees are the enjoyers of the milk. There need be only one scripture, the holy Gita, sung by Sri Krishna. Only one worshipable Lord, Sri Krishna, only one mantra, his holy names, and only one work, devotional service to the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna. These are some verses that Guru Maharaj included in praise of Srimad Bhagavad Gita. There's also more, there's Gita Mahatmya and so on, and from Vaishnav Tantra also. But this we will just leave there for now. What is very interesting is how it is described that all the Upanishads are described as being like a cow, and Krishna the milker of that cow, and Arjuna the calf. So that, what does that mean, that Arjuna is the calf? What that means is that when the calf is present, the cow gives more milk, encouraged by the affection of the cow, of the calf. The mother of the calf sees the cow and spontaneously milk flows like that. So similarly, in the presence of Arjuna, Krishna, he is able to extract the full essence of the Upanishads for our benefit. And it says the devotees, they are the drinkers of that, the enjoyers of that milk, the drinkers of that milk. So Bhagavad Gita, complete in 18 chapters, actually is quite short. Conversation, the whole conversation, less than an hour between Krishna and Arjuna. In the beginning, we know the background, the fratricidal war, and that itself is, you can say, significant in as much as it sets the scene for Bhagavad Gita. And other than that, it's historical importance and so on. That's not so crucial. What is crucial is that all of this came to a point that Krishna and Arjuna were able to have this conversation. So Arjuna, of course, we know, at the beginning of the Gita, he asks Krishna, who is known as Partha Sarathi, who drives the chariot of Partha Arjuna, to bring my chariot between the two armies. I want to see who has come for this battle. So Krishna does that, and when Arjuna sees on the opposing side his family members, his grandfather, his gurus, all of those who he reveres and loves, they're all there on the opposing side. And seeing that, he becomes overwhelmed with grief. And he turns to Krishna and says, oh, I can't, Keshava, I can't fight. My body's trembling and my bow is falling from my hand. And I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. I don't know what's right and I don't know what's wrong. I don't know, you know, what my duty is. I don't know. You know, surely, if I, with weapons in hand, if I kill all of those who are worthy of my honor, respect, and my worship, won't I just be incurring sin? And even if we win the whole earth, the kingdom of the earth, which is basically what was at stake there, what will be the benefit of that? Because those whom which we would like to enjoy that with, they'll all be dead. So what will be the benefit? So I think it's better if I just lay down my arms and just allow them to kill me. That would be better. Or maybe I should just, you know, like, live by begging. That would be a more noble way to live than to live on the blood of all of these people. So, you know, then Krishna says to him, yeah, you're speaking all these very like learned words, or you know, sounding, your arguments all sound very good and everything, but actually you're mourning for that which is not worthy of mourning. This is the beginning, the first chapter. We see the armies and all of, there's so many names of different warriors there, you know. If you haven't read the Mahabharata, if you're not familiar with the backstory, so to say, it doesn't really mean so much, all those names. And I remember, you know, when I first read Bhagavad Gita, that was all those names, they were so bewildering to me. Yeah, it was double Dutch, more than double Dutch. Sanskrit. So, you know, then and I couldn't even pronounce them, let alone did I know who they were. Now I know, because now, you know, things have moved on. I've know, Mahabharata, and you know, I didn't see the Bollywood movie, you know, but but I've read the Mahabharata, different versions. But you know that sometimes the first chapter is the most difficult chapter for the new student of Bhagavad Gita. First, because of all of that, all of the names and so on, you know, it's very difficult to sort of get beyond all that. And secondly, because of its where it's set. People say, oh, Bhagavad Gita is just glorifying war. Or you get the opposite of that, where, you know, some so-called scholars who say it's all just an allegory, you know, it's not, the battlefield's the body, and, you know, that all of the, you know, like, it's just an imagined thing. So both sides of that. But who, if you can go beyond that first chapter and persevere, it's well worth it. And the second chapter is where, you know, things start to become very interesting. In the second chapter, Krishna describes the constitution of the soul. What is the soul? The soul is eternal. How the soul is never born or never dies, is not created, is not destroyed, is not slain when the body is slain. And then he also speaks about the transmigration of the soul as we leave, discard, just as we discard worn out clothing. So when the body becomes worn out and useless, then we discard that and the soul moves to another body. There's the process of, or the idea of reincarnation. And of course, to many Western thinkers, that in itself is a very foreign concept, reincarnation. Oh, I don't know if I believe in that. Reincarnation. But actually, if you think about it, it's the only... it's the only explanation which makes sense if we are to believe in a benevolent God. Because if we think that there's only one life, then the conclusion, you have one or two conclusions to make from that. One is that it's all just random, and you're born and you die, and everything, you know, everything has some value as long as it's in existence, and then it's all over. So, you know, that's the more or less the atheistic view of life. Or if you're a religious person, then that means you've got like this life to get it right, or you're damned to perdition forever. So that doesn't sit well with the idea of God being merciful and benevolent. That means, you know, it's a pretty tough test. You know, and the odds are stacked against you, aren't they? You know. In this world, so you know, then.
And some people have a better start than others.
And there's that, of course. Yeah, some people are born with a silver spoon in their mouth, and some people are born in the gutter, you know, without even a bowl of rice to eat. So, that also doesn't sit well with the idea of God being benevolent. So, anyway, Krishna explains very clearly and simply and concisely the process of the transmigration of the soul, or reincarnation, the nature of the soul. And the second chapter is actually called Sankhya Yoga. So Sankhya Yoga is the part of Vedic knowledge which deals with karma and jnana, and analysis of what is what. More or less, you can say, in the negative side, from... we're talking about the manifest world, not so much to do with the unmanifest world or the spiritual reality. Sankhya deals with, you know, the nuts and bolts of what makes the world move. So in this chapter, Bhakti is hinted at faintly, not very given much expression so far, but the basis now is there, you know. Then Krishna is explaining this basis that we're not the body, and you know, whatever happens actually is whatever's destined to happen, and Arjun's choice is whether that he will be instrumental in that. Krishna says, you know, everything's happening by my will anyway, but I want you to be my instrument. So really it's up to you whether you, you know, take that position or whether you decide to do something else. So then in chapter 3, then Krishna begins to speak about philosophy more. Karma Yoga, chapter 3 is Karma Yoga, or the path of action. Then Krishna explains how, you know, different types of action and what that actually means in as far as how we're implicated in the web of action and reaction. And that actually we have to do our duty in the world, but we're not to be attached to the fruits of that. Now, you know, we think if we're working for a particular goal and the result of that, if I'm the person who did that, then I'm the person entitled to the fruits of that. But Krishna says, no, you're not. I'm the person who's meant to be the recipient of the fruits of your action. Your all that you have is your duty. Actually, that's, you're entitled to do your duty, but the fruits of that belongs to me. So here, this is a revolutionary idea to begin with, that we're not meant just to toil and live, but rather, but Krishna's not saying there won't be any toil. He's just saying that the result of that, you should offer that to me. And then in varying degrees what that means. But ultimately, nishkama karma yoga, Krishna speaks about how we are to dedicate all of our actions to Krishna. And then the next chapter, jnana yoga, speaks about the superiority of transcendental knowledge as being the best means for freeing ourselves from the bondage of this material world by knowledge. So, and Krishna says, and the path to attaining knowledge is by selfless action. So, one automatically rolls into the other, so to say. So then in chapter 5, Karma Sannyas Yoga. So, and that, this, now Krishna explains more closely about the renunciation of action and the difference between that and the renunciation of the fruits of action. But he says, you know, that the goal is the same. Karma Sannyas and Nishkama Karma Yoga, the goal is the same. The goal is to attain Brahmagyan, knowledge of the spirit. So then when you attain the knowledge of the Atma, that means the individual self, and of Brahman, the all-pervading spiritual energy of the Lord, the Paramatma, the Lord dwelling within the heart of all living beings, the witness of all living beings, and ultimately Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is independent of all of those things. And when you understand the classification of all of those, that's known as Brahmagyan proper. So, and those who have that understanding, they're fit for devotion to Krishna, eligible for pure devotion. And that's the path of blissful realization. And chapter 6 is Dhyana Yoga, or the path of meditation. So then there Krishna explains that there are different like stages of development. Nishkama Karma Yoga, as we already discussed, selfless action dedicated to the Lord. And Dhyana Yoga means like contemplation on the Lord, a contemplation on the self, conceiving of the self as the eternal servant of the Lord. And then also he explains Astanga Yoga, the eight the eightfold process of mystic yoga, which, you know, most people, Ashtanga yoga, or at least part of Ashtanga yoga, is which most people conceive of as yoga. You know, when you go to the community center and you learn asanas, that's part of Ashtanga yoga. But actually, it's only like one of the preliminary parts of Ashtanga yoga, eight. And the topmost, the end of those eight processes, and asanas may be the third or fourth set. And the last is samadhi. And so samadhi is, you know, when you're awake, fully awakened in spiritual consciousness, you can say. So yogic practice, this yogic practice that aims at samadhi, and Krishna also speaks about bhakti yoga and the ultimate aim of bhakti yoga, which is divine love for the Lord himself. Then chapter 7, jnana vijnana yoga, jnana vijnana. You can say jnana, it means knowledge, and vijnana means realized knowledge. So jnana means, you know, like book knowledge or theoretical knowledge. You understand the theory, but vijnana means when you actually realize that. So these two, knowledge and realization of the Supreme. So here Krishna explains that bhakti, the foundation of bhakti, is shraddha, or faith. And that faith actually is impelled by the association of his pure devotees. And Krishna explains that process of how to approach his devotee and how to learn from them. And to understand the knowledge of Lord Krishna as the Supreme Absolute Reality, the Beautiful. So, and also in this chapter, Krishna explains that the bondage of the soul is all down to our misconceived idea that we are meant to find fulfillment through sense objects. So looking at that, when we understand that actually when the sense organs engage with the sense objects, if that's, you know, if we make that the aim of our life, that actually becomes the cause of our bondage and the cause of our suffering in this world. So when the soul becomes convinced that the highest goodness or the highest achievement is through the practice of devotion, then he'll take recourse to Shravan, Kirtan, Smaranam, etc., all dedicated to the Supreme Lord, Krishna himself. And at the same time conceiving of himself as the Lord's eternal servant. So chapter 8, next chapter, Taka Brahma Yoga. So here Krishna is explaining that unalloyed devotion is the summon bonum, and the path to eternal bliss and entrance into the spiritual realm. And here Krishna states, once one enters that plane, he never again returns to this mortal world. And in chapter 9, Rajaguhya Yoga, the hidden treasure of devotion. So now, you know, as the chapters progress, Krishna is becoming more and more, you can say, direct. You know, he's building up, and now he's telling Arjun that bhakti, divine love, is the means of attaining to real transcendence. And here he explains the three modes of nature and how we are to try to transcend the three modes of nature and engage in service to Krishna in the nirguna plane, which is above the saguna, the three modes of this material world. And actually the pure self has to connect with the nirguna plane, and as long as that principle is not like revealed to the people, then they're going to look to for fulfillment anywhere and everywhere apart from that. So, and no matter how ultimately injurious that may be to one's, you know, spiritual benefit, because by nature we can't help but seek for fulfillment, and if we don't know where to look for that, then we're going to look everywhere else that we can, you know, for, that's only natural. But those who are situated on the path of devotion, here this is also an important part in this chapter. Krishna says that my devotees, those who are fully given to my service, even if sometimes it's observed that their actions are unsanctionable by the scripture or by society, you should still consider them to be sadhu, to be saintly. And that because their aim is correct. So they may, you know, we may all fall short of our ideal, but as long as we don't compromise our ideal, we may fall short, but Krishna says that very soon he'll attain his goal. So this this theme has been further explored a little in Sridhar Maharaj's Prapanna Jivanamritam, and there he's given a shloka which says, you know, that which is by the process of being cleaned, dirt is coming out off that thing. That's not the same as something which by nature emanates dirt. They're not, they may look the same, but they're not the same. So as we discussed this before, that even somebody may be completely filthy dirty, even if they, you know, they've got their bar of soap and their towel in hand and they're heading to the shower, then we can't find any fault with them for that. So similarly, you know, those who are the devotees of Krishna, even though they may sometimes do something, Krishna says, abominable, still they are should be considered to be saintly in the real sense, because they've devoted themselves to me. He said, and then in this sense, you should understand that they are, in a real sense, more than a perfect karmi, more than a perfect jnani, and more than a perfect yogi. And Krishna tells Arjuna, if you believe this, and if you announce this, boldly announce this to the world, you will become dharmatma. You will become righteous by this. Not only the devotees who may be, you know, imperfect now, but aspiring for perfection, but you also will become perfected in your spiritual attempt by this proclamation, by this your belief, you can say. Excuse me. So then Guru Maharaj gives some explanation about that in his purports, his commentary. Then we move on to chapter 10. Chapter 10 is a very important chapter. It's called Vibhuti Yoga. And here Krishna explains some of his characteristics. When I first read the Gita, like 30 years ago, this was the chapter I liked best at that time. Because Krishna tells Arjuna all many different ways in which you can remember me, you know. I'm this, I'm that, I'm the light of the sun, I'm the ocean, I'm, you know, this way, how we can remember Krishna in many different ways. But finally he says, you know, but you should know that all of these, you like magnificent things, the magnificence of nature, beauty, grandeur, opulence, power, holiness, goodness, godliness, all of these things, they're all just, you know, like emblematic of who I am. And they're just a very small part of my, or an extension of my grandeur, of my own magnificence, my divine magnificence, you can say. And superior to everything is Krishna's transcendental, original Shyamasundara form. Krishna says, this is my original form, and this is the epitome of beauty, harmony, love, all of these things. And those, the Paramahamsa devotees of the Lord, they adore and worship this form in their hearts forever. So, and this is explained in detail in the four root verses of the Gita, which are known as the Chaturshloki, and they're found in chapter 10, verse 8 to 11. The Chaturshloki, so very good to, and Srila Guru Maharaj has given some very nice commentary on all of those verses. Then in chapter 11, that's called the Vishvarup Darshan Yoga. This is where Krishna shows Arjuna his universal form. Arjuna requests that, and Krishna shows that to him. And Krishna says to him, "That you can't see that form with your present eyes, so now I give you divine eyes. Behold my mystic opulence." Krishna reveals his Vishwarup, the universal form, and actually Arjuna doesn't like it. He's petrified to see it. It's so overwhelming, you can imagine. The whole universe, the whole of creation, everything that ever existed, that ever will exist, that you know, and all of that, like now. We can't imagine what it could be like. And the Lord, in so many forms, some beautiful, some terrifying. And he also sees amongst them himself there. And he sees all of the warriors also there. And he sees that they're all entering into the Lord's jaws and being crushed. And, you know, like he describes like moths entering into the fire. So, and you know, when Arjuna sees all this, then he's so overwhelmed with, completely loses his equilibrium. And he's terrified, and he says, "Krishna, I don't want to see this anymore. Please show me your original form." So then Krishna reveals to Arjuna his four-armed form as Narayan, and then finally his Vasudeva form as Krishna with two arms, standing before Arjuna, and Arjuna's like, "Oh, now I feel peaceful again. My heart is calm. I have my composure again." So this is like a extraordinary vision that Arjuna has, but it's not one that he particularly likes. But afterwards, I mean, it's like a shock to him as well, because afterwards, what does he do? He apologizes to Krishna. "Oh, all those times when, you know, I treated you like you were just my friend, and we joked together, we ate together, we sat on the bed together. Please, like, forgive me, you know, that I didn't realize who you are." Anyway, then chapter 12, now we're getting to the crux of things, Bhakti Yoga. So chapter 12, Bhakti Yoga. And Krishna explains to Arjuna, actually, the path of devotion is the only path to attain to the Supreme Lord. And all other paths that he's explained so far, they're all leading to that. And actually, bhakti is both the means and the end for attaining divine love. So that means, you know, bhakti sadhana, and bhakti itself. So, you know, by practicing, we become perfect. But not just by the practice do we become perfect, but by sincere practice, we invoke the grace of the Lord, and through that the Lord grants his mercy to us and we become perfect. So it's not by my endeavor, it's not by you know, my strict sadhana, or by my, you know, all the vows that I take, or, you know, what time I get up in the morning, or none of those things that give us bhakti, actually. Only bhakti gives bhakti. And ultimately, bhakti is given through Krishna's devotee. And the highest manifestation of that is Sri Gurudev. And Sri Gurudev is considered to be the manifestation or representation of Srimati Radharani. And Srimati Radharani, she is known, called as Bhakti Devi herself. So she's the embodiment of devotion to Krishna. And so all devotion to Krishna, that's her department and her grant, her gift, if you like. Mahabhav and Rasaraj. Krishna is Rasaraj, she is Mahabhav. And Mahabhav also means the highest type of devotional sentiment, but that is reserved for her. But when she's pleased with the devotees, she also shares something of that with her devotees. So then, chapter 13, next chapter, Prakriti Purusha Viveka Yoga. So this is where Krishna speaks about action, the field of action, the knower of action, all of these things. And he explains that there are two, it's called Ketragyan, the knower of action, or knower of the field of action. So there are two. One is the Jiva soul, and one is the Lord himself. So he tells Arjuna, I am Ketragyan. But we are, you know, you can say like mini Ketragyan. We have some understanding of action and the field of action. But because we are inherently susceptible to be overcome by Maya, then our perception of reality is flawed. So that's why we suffer and enjoy in this material world, because impelled by Maya, we think that we can enjoy, you know, by we can exploit Prakriti, nature. And Prakriti means nature in essence. Or you can say our environment. By exploiting our environment, we think that we'll enjoy. And this is, you know, this is fundamental to material life. This is what, you know, everybody and everything endeavors to exploit their environment in one way or another. Through science, through wealth, through, you know, what personal endeavor or whatever it is, we're all trying to exploit Prakriti. And because of that, sometimes we're enjoying and sometimes we're suffering, but as that's going on, we become bound up in the web of action and reaction. So what to do? We can't overcome that, and it's all due to our misidentification with the material world and considering ourselves to be a member of that plane. So in a misconceived idea, we think that we are meant to interact with this plane. And seriously, we are convinced of that. Even though we may sit and philosophically say that we don't believe that, still, our day-to-day life shows that at all times we are trying to interact with the things of this plane. So it's not enough just to have a theoretical knowledge of that. We have to go deeper and try to become free from that. And the best way to do that is by connecting with the Nirgun plane. And by when we connect with that plane, our addiction to this plane gradually subsides by our engagement with the upper plane. So in chapter 14, Gunatraya Vibhaga Yoga, then Krishna explains very elaborately the three divisions of material nature. and shows how actually that we're not meant to be the slave of that. So although he, you know, to begin with, it would seem like he's extolling the virtue of the sattva-gun plane. He's giving many, good commendations about the sattva-gun plane. But then near the end of there, he says, but even that sattva-gun plane, that also binds us to the material world. So ultimately, we have to try to transcend all tama, rajas, and sattva-gun and enter to the plane of Sudarshata, or the Nirgun plane. And through that, through the practice of devotion inspired by love for Lord Krishna, then we can attain to the highest plane of life, the abode of the Lord. Then chapter 15, Purushottam Yoga. So here Krishna is explaining further the difference between matter and spirit. He goes into some analysis about that. What is matter and what is spirit? And who knows these distinctions? Krishna says, who can understand these distinctions? But also, who has a proper understanding of the Akshara Purusha? The Akshara Purusha means Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Knowing what each of these is, or what the difference is, and what the gradation of those is. And how ultimately the conception of Bhagavan is the highest. Brahmeti Parameti Bhagavan Iti Sabdite. The highest revelation, the highest conception of the Lord is Bhagavan conception. Above the all-pervading impersonal Brahman, and above the all knowing and all accommodating Paramatma conception, both. Above there, the conception of Bhagavan, who is transcendental to everything. I am in everything, but nothing in me, Krishna says. Like that. Means I'm above everything. I'm not subject to anything. I'm existing in another plane. So, and this is important. You know, after we heard from Guru Maharaj, and it's in Mahabharata, that after the battle of Kurukshetra, then they're like surveying the battlefield. And there was one yogi rishi, forget his name. Maybe someone remember here, but he came, and he saw, you know, like so much death, so many women crying, so many children who are now fatherless and like this, and that Brahman, and he's, you know, has some tejas, and he's becoming angry to see that. And then he saw Krishna and he said, oh, you are the cause of all this. You are to blame for this. Then he said, then I'm going to curse you, Krishna. And he, you know, took his thread and he's going to make curse on Krishna. And Krishna said, you can try, but I should tell you, Brahman, that all of that tejas that you've built up through your life of tapasya and sadhana and all of that, however powerful you may be, when you throw it on me, it won't touch me, because I'm not existing in this plane. I exist in the nirgun plane, and whatever you have, it is all saguna, and so it'll just be wasted energy. You try to throw that to me, it won't go anywhere. So think carefully before you do that. You know, you work very hard for that. Don't just like throw it away. This is Krishna's nature, that he is above everything. Everything is happening by his will, and everything is, but at the same time, he is transcendental to it all. So then in chapter 16, Daibhasura Sampad Vibhaga Yoga, where Krishna describes the nature of the godly and the nature of the ungodly. It was very instructive. And yes, interesting, an interesting synopsis, especially of the nature of the demonic and the mentality of the demonic. But the gist of that is that faith in God and acting based on that brings one to a successful and blissful life. And that those who are faithless and lead an ungodly life, ultimately they'll come to ruin. Now this is the conclusion of that chapter. Then Shraddhaya. Shraddha Traya Vibhaga Yoga. This is chapter 17. Then Krishna explains about different kinds of yajna and dana and tapasya and so on. You know what I mean? Like different kinds of sacrifice, different kinds of austerity, different kinds of charity, different kinds of food. All of these things are all described in chapter 17. And finally he says that that all of these things, they become auspicious, ultimately auspicious, ultimately beneficial when they're related to me. So if you do sacrifice, if you do that for me as the beneficiary, if you do some kind of austerity, if that is in my name, for me, if you give something in charity, that should be for me. Like everything, basically. Whatever you eat, that should be for me. Whatever you do, whatever you give away, all of these things, that should be for me. And then ultimately that will be beneficial to you. Then actually that will uncover the nature of your own real self. And then finally, chapter 18, which we discussed last week, Moksha Yoga, the path of liberation. So here Krishna tells Arjuna, now I'm going to tell you the most secret of all secrets. And that is that the ultimate conclusion of everything I've taught you is that you should surrender to me. So, you know, after telling that, I'm telling you this, I've told you all of these things already, and I've also told you this. But again, now I'm telling you the most secret of all of my teachings. And why? Because, and I'm telling you that because you're dear to me. And I want you to know that. And then Krishna tells, Man mana bhava mad bhakta mad jaji man namaskula. Mami vaisasi satyam te pratijani kriyoshime. Surrender to me. Man mana bhava means give your mind and give your heart to me. Become my devotee, bow down to me, worship me, do everything you do as an offering to me, and you will come to me. And I promise you this, because you're very dear to me. You're Priyoshime, he says to Arjuna, you're Priyoshime. And of course we know, you know, our one name of Arjuna is Krishna Bandhu, that he is Krishna's friend. So of course someone will say, well yeah, that's Arjuna, he's very dear to Krishna, of course, But actually, the teachings of Bhagavad Gita extend beyond Arjuna, and they're meant for us. So we can believe when Krishna says, you are Priyoshime, you are dear to me, he's also speaking to us. He's addressing us because we are part of his creation, created by him. Whatever is created by him is beloved of him. It's not that he created us just to suffer in this material world, but he created us for some higher purpose, some greater purpose, some loving purpose, some ecstatic fulfillment he had in mind when he created us. And now this is he's explaining to Arjuna. Then the very next verse, Sarva Dharmam Parityaja Mamikam Charanam Raja Aham tam sarva papebhyo moksha ishami marshucha. And this is, you know, Guru Maharaj says, the clarion call verse of Bhagavad Gita. Sarva dharmam parityaja. Whatever you consider is your duty in this world, your religion in this world, your obligations in this world, that means sarva-dharma, sarva-dharma, then just leave it all behind. Forget about it and just surrender to me. Mam ekam sharanam braja. That means only me. Mam ekam, only me. And sharanam means surrender to me. Surrender yourself to me. And sharanam braja, you'll come to me in braja, in Vrindavan. Aham tam sarva papebhyo. And don't think that if you leave everything in this world, that you'll be overcome by sin for doing that. Normally we can say somebody who runs away from their obligations in the world, that's actually a sinful thing to do. You know, everyone knows, as the saying says, you made your bed, now you have to lie in it, right? So what you've already done in this world, and Guru Maharaj used to use this expression. He used to say, you know, we all know this expression, right? A bad workman quarrels with his tools. That expression. So if the carpenter's doing a bad job, he says, oh yes, my chisel's not, it's broken, you know, or my drill's not working. But the actual meaning is that he's not a very good carpenter, you know. But so he quarrels with his tools. But Guru Maharaj, he changed that slightly, paraphrased it, and he said, the bad workman quarrels with his stools. This was Guru Maharaj's, like, his expression. And what he means by that is that whatever, you know, is coming from us, we created it. So, you know, we may say, oh, this stool's coming from me, it's very objectionable, dirty, filthy, horrible, and we complain about it. But we created it by our activity, by what we ate and so on. So why should we quarrel with that? We made it. So similarly, the position that we're in life, we created that. Nobody else created that. We created that. So we should not argue with that. So, you know, whatever, you know, hand life has dealt to us, that's because we attracted that. There's no one to blame except ourselves. So, but what Krishna's saying is, okay, so you're in whatever situation you're in now, whether you're a king, whether you're a pauper, whatever you may be, the whole world is looking to you. But don't worry about that. If you surrender to me, I absolve you of that. That obligation that you have, even to the whole world, now I absolve you of that because you come to me. And no reaction will come to you. So, but when we come to surrender to Krishna, we have to be very sure that we are running to Krishna, not running away from the material world. There's a difference. It's not the same thing. What we've created by our karma, we are to face that. We're not to run away from that. The only time that it's allowable to run away from that is when you're running to Krishna, for Krishna. So that has to be genuine. That has to be genuine. No, I want to surrender to you. And Krishna knows that, and we also know that if we're honest with ourselves. We know what is our motivation. And if our motivation is that I want to surrender to Krishna, I feel compelled to surrender to Krishna, then we'll become absolved of everything. So, you know, and this runs with Jiva Goswami's explanation of the word Bhagwan. You know, generally Bhagwan means he who is like full in six opulences, right? This is the genuine, general idea, who is, you know, renunciation, wealth, beauty, fame. What are the others?
Strength. And knowledge,
yeah, so six. Who has this in their fullness? That's Bhagavan. This is the general explanation. But Jiva Goswami, he says that Bhagavan, bhajaniya guna vishishta, that means that whoever comes in contact with him, the only real, meaningful response from that contact is that we want to offer ourselves to him. That's the real response, the genuine response to coming in connection with Bhagavan, is that just spontaneously irresistibly we must offer ourselves to him. So that means that's a real connection with Bhagavan. And only Bhagavan commands that response. So then Sharanagati becomes a very natural thing, a very essential thing, a necessary thing, irresistible thing. Then who surrenders to Krishna, they don't have any obligation to this world anymore. So as Sarasvati Thakur said, you know, if you say, oh, I just have some things to take care of, then I'm coming. This is not necessary. Oh, but there's a fire. Maybe it's a small fire or a big fire, but I have to go and take care, put that fire out, and when that fire has been dealt with, then I'm coming. And Sarasvati Thakur said, no, I say, let it burn. Because you've got nothing to do with that. Let the whole world burn, and that would be better, because then you won't have to connect with those burnt things. You know, you have nothing to do with those burnt things. So, and then following that, Sarasvati Thakur said, we admit no famine in this world except for Krishna consciousness as the only famine in this world. And everything else is just, you can say, symptomatic of that. So I remember one lady, she's like famous healer, she wrote this book, and the title of the book was All Sickness is Homesickness. And actually this is the truth, that everything has its root in that. Because we're disconnected from our home, we're disconnected from our real nature, then that's experienced in this world as some kind of maladjustment, malady, sickness, and so on. So that's the only thing that's lacking in this world, is real Krishna consciousness, meaningful Krishna consciousness. So this, and Krishna says, this is what I wanted to teach you all along. This is actually what I'm trying to teach you in Bhagavad Gita. So now you've heard everything, now you decide what you're going to do. And then Arjuna says, oh, now my illusion is gone, and I'm going to do what you said I should do. I'm going to fight according to your desire. And this is, you know, this is the conclusion. Now Arjuna has fully surrendered to Krishna. But you see, Krishna didn't say, you know, you must do it because I tell you to do it. Krishna explained everything, and finally he said, so now you weigh it up, you think about it, and you decide what to do. This is essential for us to understand also, that Krishna is giving free will to us. And once given that free will, he won't withdraw that from us. So, you know, when Britain was going to give independence to India, there was a meeting with Earl Mountbatten and Mahatma Gandhi. And Mountbatten said, we're considering to give independence to you, but our only reservation is that we think you're going to make a mess of things if we give it to you, that you're not fit for home rule. And Gandhi said, you're a soldier. And that means you understand what is the value of freedom. And Mountbatten said yes. And he said, then freedom means the right to do wrong. So even if you may be right, we may make a complete mess of things, but it'll be our mess. And we should have the freedom to be able to do that. To succeed or to fail, we should have the freedom to be able to do that. And Mountbatten had to agree. And you see, and Guru Maharaj used this example to show that this is the nature of the living entity, that we have freedom. And some people say, oh, you know, that freedom is very minute. But actually, we exercise our freedom all the time. Every moment we're exercising our freedom. Will I go do this the right way, or the Krishna conscious way, or will I go the other way? I mean, ultimately, it boils down to two things. You know, there are freedom of choices. We're free to follow the direction of Krishna, or we're free to surrender to the dictates of Maya. That's the choice we have. Because we're not, you know, Daivyesha Gunamayi Mama Maya Dharataya, Krishna says earlier on, that nobody can cross over this Maya of mine. Everyone, the gods in heaven and the humans on the earth, whoever they are, they're all controlled by these three modes of material nature. This is Maya. And then, but who surrenders to me, she withdraws from them. So this is the choice that we have, and that choice is with us all of the time, at every moment. So it's not that, you know, surrender is a once and only thing. You know, yeah, I signed the sheet and I surrendered on, you know, October the 17th, 1975, or whatever it was, you know, and you know, I'm a fully fledged card carrying surrendered devotee. If only it were that easy, you know. Yesterday I surrendered with my full heart. Today, Maya came with some new proposal and drew me away. What could I do? And this is the nature. So you know, surrender is a continual thing, and until we're established in the spiritual reality, then we have to cultivate surrender. We have to understand what is surrender and how to cultivate surrender. Then, you know, Srila Sridhar Maharaj said, until you're established, you know, even in the position of Vastu Siddhi, Sharup Siddhi, Vastu Siddhi. These are like the highest positions of spiritual attainment. Sharup Siddhi means that you understand who you are in the spiritual world, what your spiritual nature is. You know, what type of person you are. Coward boy, gopi, this thing, whatever it may be, you know, I don't want to like stray into this too much, but whatever your swarup, your spiritual identity is, you know what that is, you know what your service is in the spiritual world, your eternal service to Krishna. This is called swarup siddhi. It's more or less, you know, but you're still in this body, but you know that. Not just in theory, or that, you know, someone told you that, but you actually know that, you realize that. But Guru Maharaj said, until you enter into the spiritual world proper, and you that siddhi comes out, that form comes out, that's called Vastu Siddhi. That means you're that. You're not in this material body anymore. You're established in your spiritual nature, in the spiritual world. Until you're established in the position of Vastu Siddhi, there's still possibility of falling down into the material world again. So this is how like serious it is.
Yeah.
It's not a play thing. It's not a joke. It's not, you know, Guru Maharaj would say, it's not a fun. It's a very serious thing. So, you know, and we're to take it very seriously. So the whole subject matter of Sharanagati, of surrender, is quintessential to the progressive life of a devotee. And Srila Sridhar Maharaj, when he was explaining, after he left the Gaudiya Mott, after the disappearance of Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, it was some unfortunate history, much like infighting amongst the God brothers and so on. And finally Guru Maharaj, he left and came to live alone, went to live alone. And he said, when I made this decision, it wasn't a light decision. When I, you know, he said, I left the company, the valuable company of many senior, advanced God brothers, and I came away to, you know, continue my life alone. That was, I mean, essentially, first he went to Vrindavan, and then he came to Navadvip, but he's hiding. Only a few people knew where he's staying. He's not, like, told anyone where he is. And essentially, this was, his thinking was, I'll just spend the rest of my life cultivating devotion privately. You know, I'm not going to engage with anyone. But of course, Krishna had another idea, and his godbrothers, they found out where he was, and they came to him, and you know, the rest is history. But at that point, he said, when I left my Guru Maharaj, the institution of my Guru Maharaj, and the company of my godbrothers, ostensibly to live the rest of my life alone, so then I had to think very deeply What is the one thing which is quintessential to the life of a devotee? And he said, then looking and looking and looking, and praying and meditating and so on, finally I understood that that is Sharanagati. Sharanagati. Surrender to the Lord. And this is when Guru Maharaj began composing Praponajivanamritam, the Life Nectar of the Surrendered Souls. And this book is the book, the scripture, you can say, which explains the process of Sharanagati, explains the philosophy of Sharanagati, the path of Sharanagati, everything to do with Sharanagati, how we develop Sharanagati, how we practice Sharanagati, all of these things. They're there. Prapanna Jivanamritam, life nectar of the surrendered souls. He said, I looked through the writings of the Goswamis. He said, very much inspired by Ramanujacharya's Prapanamritam and the writings of Kulashekar, the writings of other great Vaishnava saints on this subject. And he composed this Praponajivanamritam. Praponajivanamritam was first published in Bengali, and Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Prabhupada, he arranged the funds for the publishing of that first book. His sister, she paid for that. She was wealthy. She paid for that. And is a very important work. And Srila Govinda Maharaj and Srila Guru Maharaj said, like the Bhagavad Gita, we should study this every day, this book. This is essential. And, you know, you can say in one sense, where the Gita closes, Praponajivanamritam begins. Krishna closes on this note of surrender. But what does that mean? To Arjuna, we know what it meant, right? But for us, what does it mean? How do I surrender? What does surrender mean? You know, so Srila Govinda Maharaj said, what does it mean? Does it just mean, you know, surrender and lie down? Or what? Or surrender and serve? So, you know, then what does it mean? How do we develop that? How do we develop the desire for surrender? How do we understand the imperative nature of surrender, what actually surrender means in a practical way? So all of these things we find in Praponajivanamritam. So I'm thinking that after we finish Bhagavad Gita, that our next study group will be to study Praponajivanamritam. It's a very essential book and beautiful book. You can say Srila Govinda Maharaj always telling she, when he talks of Praponajivanamritam, she manifests in such a beautiful way. She came to the world. Like, he considered like that. Like, this is an eternal scripture manifested through the pen of Srila Sridhar Maharaj, you can say. And really it is wonderful, a wonderful book. So, and Guru Maharaj also, you know, he spoke many things about Bhagavad Gita. But he said, in essence, what Bhagavad Gita teaches us is, physician, heal thyself. So this is like the main thrust of Bhagavad Gita is, what Krishna is explaining to Arjuna is, you can't change the environment. So, you know, so whatever's happening in the environment, and what's the environment? Einstein said, the environment means everything which isn't me. Everything which isn't me is the environment. So, there's nothing you can do to change that, much as might want to do that, you know. There's no, like, political movement which will change the environment. There's no social movement, you know. It doesn't matter if you go with your placards campaigning against nuclear arms or whatever worthy cause it may be. It's never going to be enough, because the environment it's everything. And you can't change that. You can't mold that to be how you want it. So rather than do that, what Krishna tells Arjuna is, change yourself. Then change yourself. It's not the environment that's at fault, it's your perception of the environment that's at fault. So Guru Maharaj said, the disease is in our eye. Our vision is wrong. We have a diseased vision, so we have to correct our vision. And when we correct our vision, then we'll see nothing is wrong. Nothing is wrong, because ultimately, everything is going on according to the will of the Lord. We can't see that. We're caught in a, in a snapshot in time and space, and we're saying, well, yeah, that's wrong, and this is wrong, and there's so many wrong things. But that's because we're only seeing from a very short-sighted viewpoint. We're not seeing the big picture. Only Krishna can see the big picture. And Krishna's plan is perfect. That means everything is ultimately perfect. There's nothing to complain about. The only thing that's wrong is our perception of that. So even in psychology, they understand that. Some psychologists, they understand. It's not the situation which is the cause of your problem. It's your how you react to that situation which is the cause. So, the situation... this is in Srimad Bhagavatam, taktena kampaya shushamikshamanu. But that means my karmas come to face me. Whatever circumstance comes in front of me, it's a result of my karma. I've drawn that to me by my own actions. So as we said before, we shouldn't quarrel with that. Rather, we should adjust ourselves to respond to it in the proper way. In this way, we can see everything is actually coming to instruct us. So Guru Maharaj said, if you can understand that behind everything, the loving hand of the Lord is there, directing it. If you can see with this vision, then you'll see that everything that comes to you, is every wave is favorable. Everything is coming to help you. That because Krishna has no malice, has no nature to harm us, then if we can understand that, then we have to see the smiling face of Krishna behind everything. Then whatever comes to us, even if it appears to be opposition, even if it appears to be unjust, or whatever it may appear to us, it's actually the will of the Lord. And when we can accept it like that, then we'll see everything in a different way. So we have to adjust our vision. So this is basically what Krishna's telling to Arjuna is, this war's it's happening already. They're already dead. They're already dead. But I want you to be the instrument of that. That's my desire. And whether you accept that or not, the result's going to be the same anyway. So it's up to you. Do you belligerently refuse to accept what's inevitable, or do you go with the flow? Do you become part of that universal flow? Do you become part of that dance, the universal dance, the harmonic dance, where Krishna is in the center playing his flute? We all can all step into that dance and take our place in there. That only comes if we can adjust our consciousness, or you can say dovetailing our consciousness with his consciousness. That's the meaning of Krishna consciousness. Srila Govinda Maharaj used to say, when I merge my account with his account, when I'm prepared to do that, I merge my account with his account, then you have everything. If you merge your account with Rockefeller's account, and you've got nothing to worry about, have you, anymore? So even if your account is in deficit, when you join it with the most wealthy person, then that deficit is nothing. So similarly, when we connect with Krishna, then we have everything. We find that we're in Guru Maharaj's expression, you'll find yourself awake in another environment. You'll find yourself awake in a higher plane. No, this is just, it's about that. It's not like anything magical, although it is magical. But it's not like someone's going to wave a magic wand. Rather, it's about you adjust your own consciousness. So, physician, heal thyself. Can't change the environment, but we can change ourselves. You know, I said that before. I saw a cartoon from a magazine, you know. Like a man standing on the podium, and he's saying, "Who wants change?" And they're all saying, "Yeah, we want change." And then he says, "Who wants to change?" Everyone's silent. Now, this is the thing. You say everyone wants change, but nobody wants to change. So I think it was Mahatma Gandhi, or sometimes they say the Buddha, or whoever it was, but he said, you know, be the change you want to see. So be that, yourself be that. Adjust yourself with the universal consciousness, and you'll see things in a different way. And this is the teaching of Srimad Bhagavad Gita. And that ultimately comes by understanding, you know, these teachings, these lessons that Krishna is giving Arjuna. What is the soul? What is the nature of the soul? What, you know, what is matter? Excuse me. What is action? What is knowledge? What is meditation? What is yoga? What is all of these things? And what is devotion? All of these things are expressed in Bhagavad Gita. And if we follow step by step by step, then ultimately, then Krishna says, now you've heard all of these things. Now what I want you to do is, you know, you've got a rounded vision of the environment now. Now, considering all that, what I propose is that you just surrender to me now. Forget all about that, or whatever you think your involvement with this world is. Surrender to me and come to me. Sharanagati. So, you know, for most of us, the reality is that although we may, in theory, think this is a wonderful thing, the practicality or the reality of our being able to do that here and now may not be so. So then what to do? First of all, we have to accept the ideal. This is the ideal. The ideal is that we will live our life surrendered to Lord Krishna. That's the ideal. The next thing is that now we admit, but I'm not surrendered to Krishna. I'm a slave of Maya. I'm an addict of this material world. And not only is it difficult for me to give that up, I'm not sure I even want to give that up. But I understand it's the cause of my suffering. And it's an obstacle to my surrender to Lord Krishna. So now I have to try to understand from where I am now, you know, when I strip everything back and I look at myself, warts and all, who I am and where I am now, how do I come from here to go to there? How do I find myself as a surrendered soul at the lotus feet of Krishna? This is the question. This is what we need to search out. We need to research it. We need to establish what is it that I need to do. And here, Srila Guru Maharaj, Srila Sridhar Maharaj, he comes to our relief because he has given us this treasure, Prapanna Jivanamritam. And if we will study that carefully and sincerely, and make it a part of our daily sadhana to read Srimad Prapanna Jivanamritam every day, then the desire for surrender will be born in us, without a doubt. Definitely it will happen. If with faith we study this book, if with faith we study Bhagavad Gita, we will come to the conclusion that we must surrender to Krishna. And if we study with faith Prapanna Jivanamritam, we will come to the conclusion that this is how I surrender to Krishna. So anyway,
the copies over here.
Yeah, we have copies. Yeah, we have many copies.
Good. So, one question, very quickly.
Yes, of course.
Supposing if I cannot pronounce Sanskrit words of Bhagavad Gita,
yeah,
can I just read the purpose?
Yeah.
And give the same benefit.
Yes. No? You can. Yes. It's not about, you know, knowing Sanskrit or grammar or pronouncing the words or anything like that. The Bhagavad Gita is the song of the Lord, and is not, and the Lord can speak with us heart to heart. There's a famous story, or you know, example given of one devotee of the Lord sitting with his Bhagavad Gita upside down. He can't read anything, but he's shedding tears. And the Brahmins are walking past laughing, "Oh, that foolish fellow, look, the book's even upside down, he can't read anything." But someone asking, "Why are you crying?" He said, "Oh, I see on the picture there that the Supreme Lord Krishna, he became the chariot driver of his friend Arjuna. And when I see that, my heart overflows and tears come from my eyes." Then he can't read the Bhagavad Gita, but he'd understood the meaning of Bhagavad Gita. And this is the important thing. But hearing Bhagavad Gita, reading Bhagavad Gita, studying Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that who studies this holy conversation, by their intelligence they worship me. But it doesn't mean you have to be an intellectual or you have to be a Sanskrit scholar or anything of the kind. Who has simple faith that Lord Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and Arjuna, his devotee, was liberated from all doubt and came to the highest conclusion of devotional service through the teaching of Krishna. They have understood Bhagavad Gita. And Krishna says, you know, who understands that my janma and my karma, my birth and my activities, they're not the same as the birth and activities of the people of this world. Who understands janma karma cha me dibyam? Who understands that my birth and my activities, that they're all transcendental? They never have to take birth in this material world again. Just that. So, you know, this is all faith, a matter of faith. Yeah. And who has real faith in Krishna and that he is the Supreme Lord, then they have understood the teaching of Bhagavad Gita. And who understands that the Supreme Lord, who is the Supreme Lord, we must find what is our relationship with him. And our relationship, as I mentioned before, Srila Jiva Goswami said, the only meaningful relationship between the Jiva and Bhagavan is that that the Jiva must offer himself to Bhagavan. That's the very nature of Bhagavan, is that he draws that from the Jiva. And that's why he created us for that. So we shouldn't think that that means, you know, oh, I have to surrender to Krishna, I have to give up so many things, you know, it's going to be so difficult or anything. No, it just means actually awakening to your real nature, because your real nature is to be the eternal servant of Krishna. Your real nature is to live with Krishna in a blissful, loving relationship, eternal relationship with him. So, you know, that's not an austerity. that's not something that we, you know, we have to force on ourselves. It's the most natural thing and the most wonderful thing. And it's only our diseased nature that's preventing us from doing that. So this is our goal, this is our project, if you like, in this life, is to try and overcome that. It's by, you know, somehow or another to overcome that diseased part of our nature and awaken our real, true nature. But the fact is that we're probably going to need some help to do that. So for that matter, so for that to be the case, That opens the door for us to surrender to the lotus feet of the Sadguru. These are all things that are required of us if we are serious about Krishna consciousness. And if we are a little bit serious about Krishna consciousness, Krishna will help us. Because we're not talking about a process. We're not talking about, you know, an impersonal mechanism. We're talking about a loving person. And he wants to reciprocate with us in a loving way. He wants to give himself to us. But he wants us to be fit for that. So first of all, we have to make ourselves fit for that. But because he's a person, and because it's in his gift to be able to extend himself to us in an unlimited way, then we can be assured that he'll give us all the help that we require. We just have to be open to it. And that's the difficult part.
Thinking, but repeating one thing, because he says in Bhagavad Gita in the sloka, it's Rajavidya Rajagunya,
yeah,
secret of all secrets. But he at the same time he's telling the secret.
Yeah.
So how it remains a secret?
It remains a secret because what's the ultimate secret is something that is in plain view but nobody can see. So only those who are imbued there with faith, with Shraddha, only those who are, you know, Mahaprabhu says, Sumedasa, those who have like divine intelligence, or, you know, like blessed intelligence, you can say. Only they can see that. Bhagavad Gita has been for a long time, right? So many translations of Bhagavad Gita. Not just Prabhupada's translation and Guru Maharaj. Before Prabhupada, maybe 20, 30 translations, you know, by scholars in English. But none of them, nobody read any of those and became a devotee of Krishna. I can say pretty much certainly that not one person read one of those translations and thought, do you know what, I think I'll have to become a devotee of Krishna now. No. But when they read Prabhupada's, they like thousands of people wanted to devote their life to Krishna. Because that's why Prabhupada said Bhagavad Gita as it is. You know, everyone else is like trying to wangle out some other meaning from it, or, you know, like, you know, try and explain it in this way or that way, or dissect it and analyze it and all of these things. But so all along, you know, the hidden treasure's there, but who can see it? It's right there in front of your face. But, you know, they say there's none as blind as those who will not see. So, you know, all of those, you know, the translators themselves, they read Bhagavad Gita, but they still couldn't understand that Krishna's teaching that you have to surrender to me. And Guru Maharaj said, you know, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is, he's like shamelessly canvassing for himself. So like in no other scripture in the world does the Lord speak like this, you know? I am everything to you. Give your heart to me. Like, you know, these, like, shamelessly he's telling that. And but who will heed that? Who will answer that call? And, you know, then we can say that that's the most hidden secret, because it's right there in plain view of everyone. But who will see it? So, you know, you have, like Krishna says, you can't see this form of mine with your mundane eye. So now I give you divine eyes, behold my mystic opulence. So it's actually what that means is Krishna saying, all rights reserved. All rights are reserved by me. And you can't make any demand. You can't say, oh, you have to give me, or you have to show me. There's no demand. You know, when Krishna showed his, he also showed that Vishwarup in the assembly of the Kauravas. You know, when Krishna was acting as ambassador for the Pandavas, for Yudhisthira, and before the war he came to give one final go, you know, to broker peace. Then Duryodhan, he had a plan. When Krishna comes, we'll arrest him and we'll lock him up, and then, you know, without Krishna, the Pandavas won't be able to, they won't be able to fight, because he's their inspiration, he's their everything, you know. Then they'll be dejected, and we'll be able to defeat them if Krishna's not around. So when he comes today, that's what we'll do, we'll arrest him. And he had like people positioned ready to like capture Krishna, you know, to chain Krishna up. That was his idea. So then when Krishna came into the assembly, just as Duryodhan's about to do that, Krishna showed his Vishwarup, and then he told, "Where will you put your chains, Duryodhan?" So everyone's like, "Wow," you know. But Dhritarashtra, he's blind, right? He can't see. Everyone else is seeing. He can't see. And he says, "Oh, Krishna, I can hear, you know, like what's going on." And everyone like gasping and, you know, awed by this vision. "But I can't see. So please, Lord, I'm my prayer to you is, just for a moment, take away my blindness so I can see that. So I also can see that." And Krishna said, "Oh, Dhritarashtra, it's nothing to do with whether you're blind or not. If I say you'll see, then you'll see. I don't have to, you know, restore your eyesight for that. I just have to say you can see and you'll see. Then see." Then Dhritarashtra also saw. So all rights are reserved by him. No amount of coercion or trying to supplicate him in any way can force him to show himself to us.
And Krishna says, "I can be everyone, everywhere. So whatever we do as a living being, he knows all about us."
Mm.
So how does he reward, which is he reward you do a good work, he rewards a good work, karma. And you do good, bad work, he rewards a bad work.
Yeah.
So human beings still do something wrong, accidents to you.
Yeah. That's actually Krishna not taking care of that directly. That's all going on by the law of nature. He doesn't involve himself in that. Actually, Krishna is as the Paramatma, Krishna is the observer. But he doesn't pass any judgment, and he doesn't reward or punish anyone directly. That's all happening by the laws of nature anyway. That's almost an impersonal thing. Like if you put your hand in the fire will burn you, whoever you are. It won't say, "Well, he's a very good man, I won't burn him, and he's a very bad man, so I'm going to burn him more." It's the same, right? The intensity of the fire will be the same, whether you're a saint or a sinner. And so that's just a mechanical thing that's going on. But the Lord is in the heart, but he's observing and sanctioning. Okay, you want to do that? Yes, do that. And nothing happens without his sanction, good or bad. But as far as, you know, reward or punishment, that's all happening by the law of nature. And actually, as the indwelling supersoul, the Lord is seeing everything, but he's waiting. He's waiting for us to turn to him and surrender to him. Then and only then, when we surrender to him, then he takes an active part in our life, if you like. Otherwise, I mean, he's there, but more or less it's going on in an indifferent way, you can say. So as Krishna says, "As much as you surrender to me, that much I reciprocate with you." So really it's down to us, but it's only down to us in as much as we need some initial desire. Now we see that the Lord, although he observes and he is, you can say, passive in that sense, he doesn't ignore us. When really we feel the necessity for his help. You know, when the soul turns to the Lord and says, Lord, I can't, if you exist, please help me. I can't go on like this. He'll reciprocate. He'll make some arrangement.
Yeah.
And when we say, I want to find you, he'll make some arrangement. And he will send, either he himself will come or he will send somebody to give you what you require, to bring you to him. And as much as your desire is earnest, that much he'll make the arrangement. He can do everything. Everything he does is wonderful and miraculous. And, you know, he's the most wonderful wonder of all wonders, is Krishna. And we should always never be in any doubt that whatever he does will be astonishing and incredible. And, you know, everyone in this room can probably tell you a story in their own life where that's happened to them. And they probably know half a dozen devotees where similar things have happened, but unique things have happened that brought them to the lotus feet of the Lord.
It happened to me, actually, recently, about a year ago.
All right, let's stop now, 9 o'clock. So this will be our last Bhagavad Gita class, all 18 chapters covered. Anyone who's missing any of the study notes, you can download them off the website, or you can ask me and I can give you.
What about website?
On our temple website. There you can find. All right. Jai Srimad Bhagavad Gita Upanishad ki jai. Jai Sri Krishna Arjuna ki jai. Jai Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu Harinama Sankirtan ki jai. Nitai Gaura Premanande. Jai Srila Gurudev, Jai Srila Guru Maharaj. Hariharaya Nama Krishna Jadavaya Namaha. Hariharaya Nama Krishna Jadavaya Namaha. Jadavaya Madhavaya Keshavaya Namaha. Gopal Govinda Ram Srimadusudaya.